Good morning. This is a meeting of the Utah State Tax Commission. We are meeting a little later than our scheduled time. We're at 9:10 a.m. The meeting room was being occupied by another meeting prior to this meeting. This meeting is being held in Commission Room 1025 at 210 North, 1950 West, Salt Lake City, Utah. Participating this morning are the full commission, John L. Valentine, Commission Chair, Michael J. Cragen, Commissioner, Rebecca L. Rockwell, Commissioner, Lawrence C. Walters, Commissioner, and Scott Smith, Executive Director. First item on the agenda is the public comment period. This is a time when someone who wishes to speak to the commission for up to 3 minutes on matters not related to a pending or reasonably imminent appeal to the commission may speak. Anyone wish to take that opportunity this morning? I see none. We'll move on to the next item of the agenda. Next item of the agenda is consider approving commission meeting minutes of November 14th, 2019. And I recognize Commissioner Walters on this matter.
I move we approve the commission meeting minutes of November 14th, 2019.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Any debate on the motion? Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? It passes unanimously. The minutes are approved of our meeting of November 14th, 2019. Next item on the agenda is considering amending administrative rule, and this is an action item, and I'll turn to Commissioner Rockwell on this item.
Yes. The following rule was published in the Utah State Bulletin on October 15, 2019, and the public comment period ended on November 14, 2019. We did not receive any public comments on the rule. The rule is R884-24P53, 2020 Valuation Guides for Valuation of Land, subject to the Farmland Assessment Act, pursuant to Utah Code, Section 592-515. And I'll just give you a little explanation of that. Section 592-515 authorizes the State Tax Commission to make rules regarding the Property Tax Act, Part 5 Farmland Assessment Act. Section 592-514 authorizes the State Tax Commission to receive valuation recommendations from the State Farmland Advisory Committee for implementation as outlined in that rule. The rule sets the acreage value rates for 418 separate class county combinations. This year it's proposed that 18 rates increase slightly, 261 rates decrease, and 139 have no change.
Thank you. Before I go to Commissioner Rockwell on a motion, Commissioner Walters, do you have anything you wish to add since this is an area of your portfolio?
No, I think we discussed this previously.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Rockwell, then, for a motion.
Yes, I move to adopt the amendment to R884-24P53, 2020 Valuation Guides for Valuation of Land, subject to the Farmland Assessment Act.
Thank you. Motion's on order. You've heard the motion. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Rule that passes unanimously. The rule is adopted. Next item on the agenda, approved submission of proposed rule amendments to the Office of Administrative Rules for publication. And there's five of these, and I'll let Commissioner Rockwell go through each one of these. I will just read them so we have those into the record. The first one is R861-1A-9, State Board of Equalization Procedures, pursuant to Utah Code Annotated Sections 59-2-212, 59-2-1004, and 59-2-1006. The next one would be R865-91-34, Property Tax Relief for Individuals Pursuant...
Mr. Chairman, yes. That's 9I rather than 91.
Thank you. Let me restate that one. Second one is R865-9I-34, Property Tax Relief for Individuals Pursuant to Utah Code Annotated Sections 59-2-1201 through 59-2-1220. Thank you, Commissioner Cragen, for that correction. The next one is R865-19S-79, tourist home, hotel, motel, or trailer court accommodations and services defined pursuant to Utah Code Annotated Section 59-12-103, 59-12-301, 59-12-352, 59-12-353, 59-12-603, and 59-28-103. Next one is R865-19S-96, Transit Room Tax Collections pursuant to Utah Code Annotated Section 59-12-103 and 59-12-301. Then the fifth one for consideration for submission is R884-24P-66, County Board of Equalization Procedures and Appeals pursuant to Utah Code Annotated Sections 59-2-1001 and 59-2-1004. Commissioner Rockwell, why don't you take those each in order?
Certainly. The following proposed rule amendments are for the Commission to consider and submit for publication to the Office of Administrative Rules. The rules will be published in the Utah State Bulletin on December 15, 2019, and the public comment period will end on January 14, 2020. The first is R861-1A9, State Board of Equalization Procedures. The proposed amendment requires that if a taxpayer asserts a factual error before the Commission and the county assessor fails to respond to an order to show cause within 15 days, the Commission may treat the failure to respond as if the county assessor had acknowledged the existence of the factual error.
Thank you. Any questions of Commissioner Rockwell on this one before we go for a motion? I'll make one quick observation. This has been a problem on several appeals we've had recently, and I think this would really clear up this ambiguity in the law. So, Commissioner Rockwell for motion.
I move to submit the proposed rule amendment R861-1A9, State Board of Equalization Procedures, to the Office of Administrative Rules.
Thank you. Heard the motion. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. The rule will be submitted for publication. The next one.
The next one is R865-9I-34, Property Tax Relief for Individuals. The proposed amendment includes references to Title 59, Chapter 2, Parts 18 and 19, hereinafter referred to as Parts 18 and 19, that were created under House Bill 24 and were previously included in Title 59, Chapter 2, Part 11. This change clarifies that persons claiming an abatement under Parts 11, 18, or 19 are not precluded from claiming a homeowner's or renter's credit.
Thank you. Questions on this item? That's again clears up an ambiguity, and by rule will solve a problem that's taxpayer friendly. Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move to submit the proposed rule amendment R865-9I-34, Property Tax Relief for Individuals, to the Office of Administrative Rules.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Rule that passes unanimously. This, too, will be submitted for publication. Next item.
Next item is R865-19S-79, Tourist Home, Hotel, Motel, or Trailer Court Accommodations and Services defined. The proposed amendment adds references to sections 59-12-603 and 59-28-103 to clarify that the rule applies to the Tourism, Recreation, Cultural Convention, and Airport Tax Act and the State Transient Room Tax Act. Additionally, the change clarifies the definitions of tourist home, hotel, motel, and trailer court consistent with current application of statute. And this rule amendment was done in response to some ambiguities that were identified in the process of writing a private letter ruling and should resolve those ambiguities that we identified.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Questions of Commissioner Rockwell? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell, for motion.
I move to submit the proposed rule amendment R865-19S-79, tourist home, hotel, motel, or trailer court accommodations and services defined to the Office of Administrative Rules.
Thank you. You've heard the motion. It's an order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This, too, will be submitted for publication. Next rule.
Next is R865-19S-96, transient room tax collection. The repeal of this rule would consolidate overlapping and duplicative language with Rule R865-19S-79, which is the change we just approved. With the proposed amendments to Rule R865-19S-79, this rule is no longer necessary.
Thank you. Any questions of Commissioner Rockwell on this proposed rule for publication? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move to submit the proposed rule amendment R865-19S-96, transient room tax collection, to the Office of Administrative Rules.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This will also be submitted for publication. And the final one for consideration this morning of the proposed rules. Commissioner Rockwell.
Yes, this is a companion change to one of the other rule amendments that we just approved to be submitted to the Office of Administrative Rules. Part of the change needed to be made in the County Board of Equalization Procedures, which is this rule, part of the change needed to be made in the Tax Commission hearing procedure rule. And so this portion is the county portion, and it's R884-24P66, County Board of Equalization Procedures and Appeals. The proposed amendment modifies the definition of factual error by amending the requirement that the taxpayer and assessor agree upon the error. The definition now requires that the taxpayer and assessor have recognized the existence of the error. Additionally, this proposed amendment includes references to parts 18 and 19 that were created under House Bill 24 and were previously included in Title 59, Chapter 2, Part 11.
Thank you. Questions of Commissioner Rockwell on this particular item? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move to submit the proposed rule amendment, R884-24P66, County Board of Equalization Procedures and Appeals, to the Office of Administrative Rules.
Thank you. For the motion, the motion is in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This also will be submitted for publication. So these five proposed rules will be submitted for publication. Next item on the agenda is to consider approval of our notice of scheduled meetings, and that should be the last item on your packet. That's the proposed scheduled meetings for the coming year of 2020. I recognize Commissioner Cragen for a motion to approve this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Open and Public Meetings Act requires public bodies that meet and regularly scheduled meetings to post an annual notice of when those meetings will be held. As we traditionally do at our last meeting of the year, we'll adopt this notice, which establishes that our regular scheduled meeting times are the fourth Thursday of each month, with the exception of Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Eve. So if there are no questions, I'm ready to make a motion.
Thank you. Any questions, Commissioner Cragen? Seeing none, Commissioner Cragen for motion.
I move to approve the 2020 Notice of Scheduled Meetings.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion for vote. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Rule passes. These will be our Notice of Scheduled Meetings for 2020. Next item is to consider tax commission positions on pending legislation. And there are several here that we have spent significant time on, so we'll spend a few minutes here going through these, and I'll ask Commissioner Rockwell to make some explanations since she has been the one with me who have appeared before the legislature on these matters. So Commissioner Rockwell first on acquisition cost definition. These numbers that we are giving are the file numbers. The bills have not yet been numbered, and so the file numbers are the numbers that we're going to be giving on each of these cases. Commissioner Rockwell for the first one.
So the first one is 2020 file number 0347, acquisition cost definition. And it defines acquisition cost for tangible personal property in the Property Tax Act. And this was a situation where I believe that the definition was repealed out of our rule in response to some legislation. As it turns out, we needed to have the definition in statute and had attempted to put it into a bill that Representative Dan McKay ran, and I think while he was still a representative, and the bill did not pass, and so we subsequently asked for it to be included as its own piece of legislation in as part of our legislative package before the Revenue and Taxation Interim Committee, and this just makes that definition addition in the Property Tax Act.
Well, I might say this before I start placing these promotions. It would be the Chair's intent that if these motions pass, bills that are substantial conformity with the version that we adopt in these files will be acknowledged as commission-supported bills. We'll come back to the commission if there's significant changes from the files that we're being voted on here. Any questions on that before I place the first one for motion? No. Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for motion on the first one on acquisition cost definition.
I move that the commission support 2020 FL 0347 as may be subsequently numbered. Its title is acquisition cost definition.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes. This will be supported as a commission bill. That will be supported as the commission will support this, the bill. Next item would be certified tax rate calculation amendments. Commissioner Rockwell.
And this is 2020 file 0613. Technically, the change modifies the definition of incremental value to include project areas created under Title 11, Chapter 58, Utah Inland Port Authority Act, Title 63H, Chapter 1, Military Installation Development Authority Act, and Title 63N, Chapter 2, Part 5, New Convention Facility Development Incentives. And in a nutshell, this bill defined incremental value for purposes of calculating the certified tax rate. But under traditional definitions of incremental value, we only had some of the older entity types in code, like CDAs and RDAs, and it didn't cover some of the newer types of project entities like Inland Port, MIDA, or the convention facilities, and it left us with a lack of clarity as to whether the certified rate should be calculated in the same manner with respect to incremental value. This clarifies that, gives us the direction that we need, and lets us move forward with a law that now reflects all entity types in existence for the definition of incremental value.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. Questions? Seeing none, I'll please go ahead and recognize Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL 0613 certified tax rate calculation amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Well, that passes. We will be supporting that file as soon as it's made into a bill. Next item is circuit breaker amendments. I'll let you recognize the file number on that one.
2020 FL0666, Circuit Breaker Amendments. This is a bill that we worked on with Senator Gene Davis as part of a working group that consisted of county representatives, people from the Tax Commission, and other various interested parties. Senator Davis sought to make some changes to provide a greater benefit under the circuit breaker for taxpayers. And this was done in response to an issue that we brought before the legislature in saying that anecdotally we were seeing that some individuals were not qualifying for circuit breaker and were just barely over the limit. And it caused us to question whether the circuit breaker income thresholds were keeping up with cost of living. And the legislature studied this in response to that comment. The bill does several things. First, it modifies the definition of homeowner for purposes of the homeowner's property tax credit to exclude a residence that is owned in whole or in part by any type of entity except an individual or qualifying trust. And this is actually in response to some issues that have come before us in hearing, and it clarifies the position that we took in our order. Second, it changes the definition of claimant's household income for purposes of the homeowners and renters credits to exclude the income received by a member of the claimant's household who is under 18 or the parent grandparent of the claimant or the claimant's spouse. Again, this is something that came up in hearing before us where we had income of minor individuals or parents and grandparents that were disqualifying people from receiving circuit breaker relief, and this fixes that issue. The third is modifying the formula for determining the amount of allowable property tax relief by including third-party payments in the calculation. This is another issue that came before us on hearing, and it clarifies that if a third party like an escrow company makes part of the payment, that would be calculated in. There was really just an error in the formula for computing what the refund amount would be, and it didn't allow for third party payments to be credited against the payments that the taxpayer makes. The fourth is that it increases the minimum and maximum household income brackets for qualification for the homeowners and renters credits. The maximum income bracket increased from $26,941 to $37,173. This was a policy decision by the legislature. And finally, it increases the amount of the homeowner's credit at each income bracket. The maximum credit increased from $798 to $1,012. The bill does not increase the maximum amount of the renter's credit. It's still at 9.5% of rent for the lowest income bracket.
Thank you. This was a very detailed and difficult negotiation, but we've got to recognize that Senator Davis was really helpful on trying to work through these issues with us.
And we're also continuing to work through a few additional issues that may need to be run next year, but it's a very good working group. I think people are really trying to solve some of these longstanding issues with Circuit Breaker, and it's good to have a forum to do that in the interest on the part of Senator Davis. So kind of stay tuned in this area.
We have our director of our property tax division in the room with us. Did you have anything that you wanted to add on this, or are you able to administer it the way that it's been explained?
We believe we can administer it as explained.
Okay, Denny, let's get this on the record, okay? This will be Denny Lytle, who's the director of our property tax division.
We believe we can administer it as it has been explained.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. I'll recognize Commissioner Rockwell then for motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0666 Circuit Breaker Amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. debate on the motion?
I have a question, if I could.
Oh, yes, we will. Let's have you withdraw the motion at this point, and then let's go to the question. I should have asked for questions first. Questions, yes.
These are interesting numbers, 26, 9, 41, 37, 173. Are those pulled out of the air? Is there some rationale for those? Is there any automatic adjustment included in the bill for in the future?
Yes. The amounts were based on, in part on federal, by comparing federal poverty levels. But the numbers are always odd numbers. They started out an even number, and then they're increased annually for inflation, so they end up after the first year or so being an odd number, and those inflationary adjustments will continue under the bill. After examining federal poverty data, they ended up deciding to just increase the numbers that were currently in code by a certain decile of those poverty populations, and so it is based on, an increase to bring it up a decile. And it, again, remains odd numbers because of the inflationary adjustment.
You indicated in your introduction that there was no automatic adjustment in these and consequently the threshold had not kept pace with inflation. But now, am I understanding that there isn't an inflationary adjustment?
If I said that there were automatic adjustments, I was mistaken. There are automatic adjustments. It's just that we were seeing in our cases that those adjustments were not keeping pace with the cost of living, apparently, because we were starting to see more and more people who were just barely over the threshold being denied any relief. So we decided to bring it to the legislature to see if something more was needed beyond the existing inflationary adjustments. And this would do that. It would increase it, and then the inflationary adjustments would kick in the year after implementation.
Thank you for that clarification.
So, Commissioner Rockwell, would it be fair to say then that there were adjustments in the pre-existing statute?
There have always been adjustments.
But that those adjustments were insufficient to reflect the policy that was that the legislature was trying to do in regards to poverty levels.
It appeared enough to us that might be the case that we decided to bring it to the policymakers. Of course, what we see is always just anecdotal that, we have a few cases where somebody's a few dollars or a few hundred dollars over the limit, and you kind of cringe thinking that these were people who had qualified before and are now not qualifying. And so we felt like it was enough of a concern to bring it to the legislature, and the legislature decided the policy and made delineations on the increases under this bill.
Thank you very much. Any further questions before I go back to Commissioner Rockwell for a motion? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0666 Circuit Breaker Amendments.
Thank you. You've heard the motion. The motion's in order. Debate on the motion? Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This, too, will be supported by the Commission. Next item is fuel sales tax amendments. Commissioner Rockwell for explanation.
It's 2020 FL0664, fuel sales tax amendments. This clarifies that in situations where a single meter is used to provide fuel, and by fuel we mean gas, electricity, heat, fuel oil, or other fuels, for a combination of residential, commercial, or industrial uses, the tax status and tax rate for the consumed fuel is determined by which use is predominant. And this, again, is an issue that came up in one of our hearings where the rule currently requires the division to look at and adopt the predominant use. But under the statute, there was no authority to do that. We became concerned that the rule perhaps exceeded the scope of statute, so we brought it to the legislature and asked them if they wanted to codify this or another position for determining mixed meter fuel use, and they decided to codify what we are currently doing in rule, which puts us on more solid footing in the decisions we make in that regard.
Thank you. Any questions of Commissioner Rockwell on this one? Yes, Commissioner Walters.
Is the concept of predominant clearly defined?
Predominant isn't defined, but it is included on the information that the utility provides to the division. And after discussing this with the division and with industry and with legislators, we decided that the practice, which has been a long-standing practice between the utilities, the taxpayers and their representatives and the division, that there was not a problem with that determination, and we decided that if it wasn't broken, we weren't going to fix it at this point. So we've left predominant use as it stands.
So it is the fuel provider who defines predominant and determines what the predominant use is?
Yes. And then, of course, if they're audited, they have to back that up with documentation on audit.
They mean the taxpayer?
The taxpayer, yes.
But it's the utility that's deciding whether or not that taxpayer is predominant use is commercial, residential, or industrial use?
Yep, it's reflected in the billings for the utility. And we had some pretty significant discussions on whether anything more needed to be done with predominant use, and kind of ended up taking the position that if it's not broken, we won't fix it. That being said, if in the future an issue arises, we can always go in and examine that. But keep in mind that this is not changing what we have always done. It's just continuing to do what we have always done. It's just that it's now authorized by statute rather than by rule. And it's been in place for a significant amount of time with no issues having been raised.
How often does it get audited?
I have no idea. I have no idea. We'd have to have someone from the division present to answer that question.
Let's turn to our executive director. He may have an answer.
So Commissioner Rockwell's right. It's the supplier that either charges or does not charge the tax. And so the manufacturer would give them an exemption certificate. So they do it in consultation with each other. And historically, it's been 51%. Now, that sometimes is based on different criteria. It could be based on square footage of manufacturing or where it qualifies for the manufacturing versus where it doesn't. It could be based on the type of machinery and equipment. But we will, every audit we do, we look into that.
But isn't there a differential rate between commercial and residential that you don't necessarily have an exemption certificate for the residential component side?
So in this case, residential typically wouldn't apply because these are manufacturers.
But it says a combination of residential, commercial, or industrial.
So if we're a combination of a store in the ground level and the apartment in the upper level of the same building that's serviced by the same meter, how would we determine predominant use? How would the utility determine predominant use in that case?
Of course, they would work with the owner of the facility to determine. And again, it could be
reflected on their utility bill. Whichever use was used the most, whichever had the greatest use, would be the rate that would apply.
So do we ever challenge the utility's determination of who is the predominant user?
So remember, in these cases, it's where you have a single meter. So if you had a separate meter for residential and manufacturing or whatever, then it would be whatever that meter was applying to.
Yeah, we get that.
So this would be single meter that does a whole building, so you have residential on or you have commercial on the ground floor and residential above that. Again, the provider of the fuel would work with the owner to determine based on, again, it could be square footage, it could be, depending on if you had huge machines that you know are using more, and so square footage wouldn't work. But it as Commissioner Rockwell's pointed out, this is really, we haven't had any issues with this. This has been, with 50, predominance 51%, and it's pretty easy to show. Typically, it's not that close. And so, it's from an auditing division, we support this, and it really makes auditing a lot simpler.
And I even asked Kate Bradshaw to survey her clients that had a mixed use commercial and residential, where we kind of have this resurgence in the business model of having your storefront on the bottom and the residence on top, and some of that's kind of going on the 9th South area. And she surveyed her members, and even they said that this isn't going to be a problem. I think a lot of people are doing separate metering on it. Again, I think if we were trying to define predominant use, because there are different measures that can be used, it would be very difficult to define that and make sure that we've caught all of the possible scenarios where you could be having, a predominant use. And I just don't know that we understand the breadth and depth of all of the industries here to be able to easily craft a definition. So we figured that where it seemed to be pretty unanimous that there isn't a problem in this area, and it reflects longstanding practice, that we would just codify the rule.
And I'm not suggesting we shouldn't, but I guess I'm concerned that the entity making the determination of what constitutes predominant has no vested interest in getting it right. And, that I don't know that we should not support this bill, because, as you say, it codifies what we've been doing. But I'm wondering how often that determination is challenged and verified. And that's probably a discussion for another day.
Again, it's the fuel supplier in conjunction with the manufacturer. I think the manufacturer has to be the one that initiates it with the supplier, because they have to give an exemption certificate. So the supplier is just not going to give it to someone on their own. Their customer has to initiate that.
But I think the bigger problem is the mixed use between commercial and residential.
Yeah, and I never ran into that as an auditor. I think it's more prevalent that you have these mixed use with the residential above.
Anecdotally, it feels like with residential and commercial, they more often have separate meters, in which case this doesn't even apply.
Yes, that's true. Okay, any other questions? This has been a very robust discussion. Thank you, Commissioner Walters. Seeing none, I'll go to Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0664 fuel sales tax amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Rule that passes. This will also be supported as a commission-supported bill. Next item is non-resident income amendments.
This is 2020 FL0525, non-resident income amendments. This allows a non-resident individual to allocate wage income proportionately between Utah and other states, according to where the income was earned, instead of using corporate UDITPA provisions. This actually, again, codifies our current practice. The issue and the ambiguity arose out of a decision that came before the commission, and it was clear that the statute really pointed back to UDIPPA for allocating the income of non-resident individuals, where UDIPPA is more appropriately used for sourcing business income, and it didn't reflect how that income was being allocated on individual income tax returns. So we approached the legislature about making that clarification to show in statute how income is allocated for non-resident individuals on the return.
Very good. Questions on this one? This one just went through last Wednesday for the committee. I recognize Commissioner Rockwell for motion.
I move that the commission support 2020 FL0525 non-resident income amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Rule that passes unanimously, and this also will be supported as a commission bill. Next item is Property Assessment Procedures Amendments. Commissioner Rockwell.
This is 2020 FL0612, Property Assessment Procedure Amendments. This repeals Section 59.2.212. This is an issue that came before us by motion, and we were asked to assess property under 59.2.212. And in reading the section, became very concerned about a few provisions in it. I think that some of the most concerning provisions is that it allows us to assess property outside the hearing process. And if we do that, it allowed one commissioner to act on behalf of all four commissioners rather than acting as a quorum. It did not clearly grant the parties rights to present evidence and have that evidence considered by that one commissioner. And it also set up procedures that were different than what our typical procedures are, and that's UWAPA, for handling these types of administrative procedures issues. And based on that and the fact that we had never exercised authority under this section, at least since Denny has been in Property Tax Division, we requested that this section be repealed. We did testify in committee that if we had occasion to make an assessment, and we feel like we have that authority under our plenary authority, the powers and duties of the commission, that we would do it, but we would do it as a quorum and in accordance with UWAPA, rather than by following such a potentially unfair process that's currently established in statute.
Thank you. This one was a very interesting debate in the committee and the legislature, because there was a concern that there needs to be some kind of a safety valve to be able to deal with these types of assessments, but we think that the statute as it was presently constituted did not do a fair job of how that process would work. We like the way that this is proceeding a lot better. Thank you, Commissioner Rockwell, for your help on this. Any questions on this particular potential bill? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0612, Property Assessment Procedure Amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Rule that passes unanimously. This will be a supported bill of the Commission. Next item, sales tax on motor vehicles.
This is 2020 FL0348, sales tax on motor vehicles. This bill provides that when a dealer sells an aircraft, manufactured home, mobile home, modular home, motor vehicle, or watercraft over the internet, the location of the transaction is where the purchaser takes receipt of the property. This issue arose with the proliferation of internet sales of vehicles. Streamlined sales tax allows states to decide on the sourcing of motor vehicle sales. Our state laws were really structured to address only those sales that occurred at a physical location of a dealer and not those where the primary transaction took place on the internet. This provides that if it is an internet sell, then the location of the transaction is where the purchaser takes receipt, and clears up that loophole that's in the law.
Might say by way of observation, this then makes these sales the same as any other online sale as far as sourcing. I think that that's a fair way to be able to continue to source so that we have predictability in the sourcing. Any other questions?
Yeah, I do have a question on this one.
Commissioner Walters.
I'm wondering how we're defining sale. Because if I, you know, if I buy a motor vehicle online, I'm not cutting the check online. I may give them a credit card for a deposit, but then I'm going to, in all likelihood, if I'm going to go to the dealership to pick up the vehicle and deliver the rest of the cash. Where did the sale take place? When I placed the deposit, or when I paid the rest of the money and took delivery?
So, SST uses the term location of the transaction as opposed to sale. If we had some discussion on this in committee, and it's my understanding that if somebody just goes into a website and looks at cars, and then they ultimately place an order for that car, but it's being sold by a dealership and they're paying the dealership that has a brick and mortar location in the state, that that would not be viewed as an internet sale because the car is ultimately being paid for and sold by the dealership. But that if they actually transacted the payment over the internet, and then, like in, for example, a Carvana situation where the payment took place over the internet and they were only having the car delivered to them either through one of Carvana's kiosks or if it was being delivered to their home, which in some cases it is because there is no brick and mortar dealership in the state, then that would be the type of internet sale that would be sourced to where the purchaser takes receipt. Does anyone dispute that? I mean, that's kind of how the discussion went in committee.
In the committee, they specifically talked about the Carvana type situation where the delivery occurs at the home. The payment was made online. The car's put on a transport. The car's unloaded off the transport on the front driveway of the purchaser versus someone who goes into a website for, they use Larry Miller as the example. Larry Miller has a website. They like the car. They say, fine, this is the car I want. They purchase the car. They put the deposit down, and they go to the dealership and pick up the car.
And maybe pay for the rest.
And pay for it the rest of it.
And also the emergence, and I've only seen the Carvana ads on TV, but I understand that they have like a multi-level car kiosk. And I understand that those transactions are paid for and completed over the internet, and the only thing that's being done at the kiosk is the delivery.
And probably, well, then the question, well, different issue, I suppose. Okay. Scott's got a comment. Scott,
yeah, I think what's important to remember is under Wayfair, if these internet sellers of automobiles have nexus because they have enough sales, then they would be a seller, and they would have to collect the tax at, or if they were to use a courtesy with one of our local dealers. So these people, and I know that different states have different laws for their dealers, and if a dealer makes the sale, they have to do the paperwork. And so at that time, so that would be the seller. And so I think most of these are going to be, if it's just an individual and you buy it off the off the internet, then you're just going to license that at the motor vehicle office, and they would collect tax at that time.
The big concern was sourcing, actually, rather than who was going to be collecting the tax, and that was the sourcing issue was important because it was determinative of how the local sales tax would be allocated, whether there would be a point of sale or whether it would all be allocated on population. And so the determination in the bill as you have before you is that if there was only economic presence in the state, no physical presence and no physical other than the delivery that occurred from a third party, that those would be sourced based upon the point of delivery rather than sourced based upon some other place.
And you're right. And your earlier comment that says this will be consistent with how we handle all other internet transactions, is that's the key here, is that it's consistent.
Okay. But it's also relevant within the state because you have different sales tax rates in different jurisdictions. And so
right.
I may buy a car on the internet from a jurisdiction that where the physical presence is in a jurisdiction with a lower rate.
Yeah, you may live in Park City, for example, which has one of the highest rates in the state, and take delivery in Juab County, which has one of the lower rates in the state.
And we did have some discussion about that in committee and the possibility that, you know, there could be some tax planning that goes on to have those vehicles delivered in a lower tax jurisdiction. But ultimately, the committee decided that having the sourcing be where the purchaser takes receipt is the policy that the legislature wanted to adopt.
And remember that this only applies to out-of-state transaction. So if you have an in-state transaction with an individual, that's going to be sourced to the individual's address, and it always has been. If it's a dealer, then the dealer is going to charge tax based on their location, even though it could have been an internet transaction. That would be considered an intrastate transaction, and it would go to the dealer, just like any other transaction. If you buy from a Utah location and you buy it on internet, that's going to be sourced to that Utah location, not the purchaser's location.
10:30 to 11.
Thank you. Any other questions on this particular one? This was a one that we spent a significant amount of time in the committee on. If not, then I'll go to Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move that the commission support 2020 FL0348, sales tax on motor vehicles.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This will also be supported by the commission. Next one, tangible personal property tax revisions.
This is 2020 FL0563, tangible personal property tax revisions. This is actually an error that we caught in a bill that was passed last year. The bill increased the personal property exemption from $10,000 to $15,000. The language in the bill has a consumer price index adjustment in it, but the base year for making the consumer price index adjustment was not adjusted. I believe it was left at 2013. And so in the first year of implementation, there would have been 6 years worth of inflationary adjustment if that base year wasn't fixed. And so we contacted last year's sponsor and she corrected that so that we only have 1 year of adjustment occurring in the base year.
Thank you. Questions on this one? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for a motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0563 Tangible Personal Property Tax Revisions.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This will be supported by the Commission. Next item is Tax Commission Authority Amendments.
This is 2020 FL0346, Tax Commission Authority Amendments. This repeals the Tax Commission's authority to adjust or defer taxes imposed on centrally assessed property and authorizes the county in which centrally assessed property is located to adjust or defer taxes imposed on that property. This arose when the Commission was asked to adjust property taxes imposed on a centrally assessed property. And through the course of the discussion, it was noted that it's really the county elected officials who are elected to oversee their budgets. And if the Commission goes in and adjusts the tax on a taxpayer within that county, it takes away their ability to control their budgets and be responsible to the voters who elected them. And we felt uncomfortable with that authority remaining with us. Keep in mind, this is not the determination of value, but actually the adjustment of taxes. And so we asked to have that authority repealed and given to the county.
We felt really important that on this particular one that we still maintain the constitutional requirements of determining value at fair market value, but that if the county chooses to abate or defer taxes, that's their budgetary decisions, and that's why we made the recommendation to the legislature on this particular one. Any questions? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0346 Tax Commission Authority Amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Well, that passes unanimously. This will also be supported by the Commission. Next one, tax exemption for construction or should be of unoccupied properties.
Ooh. Or unoccupied property.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tax exemption for construction or unoccupied property.
Yes, this is 2020 FL0349. The bill allows the county assessor to consider property under construction or unoccupied as residential property for purposes of property tax if the assessor determines that the property will be later used as a primary residence. This is a long-standing practice of ours. It has relevance in both the property tax and income tax areas as far as determining what is a primary residence. This is an area where we felt like unoccupied property or property under construction were in some cases being treated as residential property, but the authority to do that was not clear in statute, and so we asked that it be placed in statute rather than just an administrative rule.
Thank you. Questions on this one?
Does unoccupied property also include unoccupied land? If you have a residential building lot that is not doesn't necessarily have a current building permit on it, but it will be residential?
All I know is how we've analyzed it for purposes of the charitable exemption, and we've decided that no, there has to be some level of improvements in place and it actually be the property actually being used in order to qualify. I haven't encountered it in terms of the application of the residential exemption. Denny might have more thoughts on that.
Well, that property right now is typically not given a residential exemption until it's
actually used. Right. That would be my thinking on
but
it.
But does unoccupied property include unoccupied land is my question.
And my thinking would be no, but I would have to turn to Denny.
Okay. can. Mr. Lytle, if you come to the microphone, please.
Denny Lytle, Director of the Property Tax Division. Commissioner Walters, to my knowledge, no is the answer. We would never consider applying the resident, never have or under this bill would consider applying the residential exemption to land only, no matter what kind of land it was. That there would have to be actual construction in place for the exemption to apply.
I mean, usually when it arises is when somebody moves out and they don't keep their belongings or really a right to reaccess the property and have it listed for sale. And that's when it's treated as unoccupied and still given the residential exemption. But I have never run it into a case where unoccupied land alone has been challenged. The only situation that I've run into where unoccupied land has been asked to be given an exemption was charitable, and we said no.
That's consistent with my experience as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lytle. Any other questions before we go to the motion? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell for motion.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0349, tax exemption for construction or unoccupied property.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing no debate, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Rule that passes unanimously. And this bill also will be supported by the Commission. The final one is property tax notice amendments.
This is 2020 FL0614, property tax notice amendments. This allows a person who is entitled to receive information related to property tax to designate another person to receive the information. This again came out of one of our commission decisions. We felt like in other tax areas that we could address this administratively and allow a representative to receive notice, but in the property tax area, it would require a statutory change. We know that some of the counties are not currently allowing reps to receive the information, and this would require them to allow a rep to receive information if the taxpayer so designates.
Thank you. Questions on this one? Seeing none, Commissioner Rockwell.
I move that the Commission support 2020 FL0614 property tax notice amendments.
Thank you. Motion's in order. Debate on the motion. Seeing none, I'll place the motion. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Well, this passes unanimously. This also will be supported by the Commission. Next item on the agenda is Commissioner reports. Any of the Commissioners wish to give a report? I've got one quick one. I just returned from the annual board meetings of the Federation of Tax Administrators in Washington, D.C. last week, and I can tell you Washington, D.C. still has all the traffic flowing every place. Even though the impeachment inquiries seem to be taking up all of the air in all of the rooms, they're still getting work done. There was a bill that passed that I wasn't even on my radar. Its acronym is FTA, which is obviously also the acronym for the Federation of Tax Administrators, but it's called the Fair Taxpayers Act, and it apparently passed sometime late summer. And it has some things that may be effective for us. I'm just starting to get the information on it now, and I'll go ahead and brief everybody once I've had a chance to review it. There was a number of other things, and I can talk all offline about some of the other things that were discussed, but it was a very good set of conferences and good explanations of what's happening specifically in California and New York. So with that, that's my report. Go to the executive director. Do you have a report that you mentioned?
I don't have anything.
Okay. Thank you. I'll turn to Commissioner Walters for a final motion today.
I move we adjourn.
Motion to adjourn is in order. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Well, it passes. We're adjourned.